Welcome into another edition of New Track Record Podcast. Caleb Hatch and Justin Kinney with you, bringing you up to speed on all the IndyCar news in the last week. Hello, Justin.
Hello, Caleb. How are you?
Doing well. Ready for mud season to begin here in Indiana?
Yeah, as quick as we got a bunch of snow, it's quickly disappearing, especially over the last day or two. But soon we will have a lot of mud.
Yes, and it will not be fun. But you know what's fun? There are IndyCars testing. And
yes, sir.
You know, we'll get to more on the overall test, but I think the highlight, Romain Grosjean had his first test, and there are different testing times. You know, I guess they didn't use push to pass in the morning session, and then in the afternoon they did. And he was within a second of Rinus VK's top time in the afternoon, from reports that I've seen. All in all, solid first day. He had a spin that everyone freaked out, and then he ended up coming back out, and what, an hour or so later?
All the Grosjean haters, oh, see, look at Grosjean crashing, when it's just literally his first time ever in an IndyCar and the first time ever at Barber.
Which is a very tough track to be your first test day.
Yeah, a lot of people talk about the physicality of some of these tracks, but we've seen drivers say the most physical on the schedule is Barber. No joke.
Uh-huh. So, and he had some pretty funny quotes talking about, you know, my biceps really got going there, early on. And
without power steering.
Using some muscle memory that you're probably not used to in F1. But I think with him coming to IndyCar, and he'll be back on track in just in a few days as we record this on Thursday, February 25th, he's set to test at WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca with Dale Coyne Racing and Rick Ware Racing on March 1st. So
Monday,
He'll have another test day pretty soon for him to get more feel of the car, and that's another tough track for a driver. But, all in all, I think he sounded very positive, and he just – the quotes that I saw, it made it sound like he felt at home here and he felt comfortable. I mean, not just with Bourdais, who he's apparently friends with, but also Pagano, and just seeing, the IndyCar guys, he felt comfortable here.
Welcomed.
He felt like he could just drive the car.
Yeah. I feel, something that caught me, that you don't think of until they mention it is Grosjean mentioning, he's over here and, the garage doors are open and the cars are out of the garage, or, the secrecy of Formula One is such that, you can never get around the cars, right? Especially other cars. But it's a lot more open, and you mentioned, it's a spec series, so obviously that's going to be allowed. But, certain areas of the car can be developed and stuff like that. But it's just, I feel like he felt relaxed. I feel like he just could come out and just drive a car and not worry about being X amount slower, considerably slower than the better teams. And, the welcoming paddock that really, open arms and really allowed him to come in and feel like one of the guys right away. I just feel like it's a relief for him to get to a place where both on track and off the track, he can be a little bit more comfortable.
All right. So let's get to the controversial part of all of this.
Yes.
And it's an article by Racer.com's Chris Medlin, who will be joining us next week here on New Track Record. To talk F1 drivers transitioning to IndyCar, and also a little bit of F1, I'm sure we'll trickle in with that conversation with Chris. But this headline, Haas pulled Grosjean IndyCar sponsorship after Bahrain crash. What?
This caught me by surprise, and it was a fascinating read. What did you feel when you initially read it?
I understand Gene Haas's, comments and reason to pull it back, because a car getting wadded up, what's that gonna cost you? $10-20 million,
right?
But the quotes that he had, I think I saw someone put that they lacked tact or tactfulness, and just did not really come across very well.
I appreciated the honesty of Gene Haas. Sometimes I just get it, sometimes I just want to hear it the way you're thinking. And yeah, he wasn't very tactful, but you know what? In today's world, I'm fine with that. And I understand what Gene Haas was saying. Most drivers have one big shunt in their career, like a huge shunt that could go one of two ways. And I think Gene Haas is thinking, look, he had that one that miraculously he not only survived, but walked away from. And I think Gene Haas is thinking you had that, and now you're kind of just playing with fire at this point. I understand it. And look, it's Gene Haas's money. He can do whatever the hell he wants with it.
Yep.
You know, so people complain, oh, how could you do that to Romain Grosjean, or, you know, complaining about that. It's his money. He can do whatever the heck he wants with it. Right. So he said it in a way that probably wasn't the best, but I appreciate the candid talk, because I think so many times we're hidden behind cliches and, you know, what you want to hear, or as opposed to what you really want to hear in terms of what they're thinking. And, you know, Gene Haas said, I didn't feel comfortable sponsoring him in a car with what could happen. And I don't think that's just an IndyCar thing. I think maybe if he would have went to another Formula One team or returned to Haas or did something, or maybe even, you know, Gene Haas wouldn't have welcomed him back if he came to Haas because of it. I don't know. But I don't think there's any bigger story here. Some conspiracy theories, he didn't want to throw money at IndyCar or whatever. Like, I don't think it's like that. I think this is just plain that Gene Haas felt that Romain Grosjean should have retired after that crash, and he didn't. And he didn't feel comfortable supporting him continuing a race. And that's his decision.
Well, and he's in NASCAR, he's in F1, so IndyCar's the one he's not in. And look, I get that IndyCar's not on the level of those other two as far as TV ratings and audience and things like that. But it sounds like that Gene was strongly looking into it, and he was prepared to be a part of this. I think the money quote here by Gene in the article, I don't know, he has a wife and three kids, and I just told him I couldn't see giving him money to go out and kill himself. I just felt like he needs to stay home and take care of his family. He escaped the big one there. If he really understood what happened there, if that car had been a few degrees one way or the other, he wouldn't have been able to get out through that hoop, and he would have died. So extremely lucky.
I think this just shows the difference between a driver and a non-driver. You know, Romain Grosjean shakes off probably certain death or near death. And after being shook for a couple weeks, probably, he was back on the horse. He was back to get back into a race car. But a non-driver looks at that, myself included, and go, if that happened to me, I'm never driving in an auto race again. And I think that's where Gene Haas is coming from, is, man, he became so close. And I think the majority of us would look at that and say, okay, I'm done. But drivers are made different. They think different. And Romain Grosjean was ready to get back on the horse once he really gave some thought to it. And that's his decision, just as it's the decision of Gene Haas to not financially support that venture.
To Gene Haas's credit, at the end of the article, the quote is, that was probably the happiest day in racing, was to see him jump out of that car. So, again, I don't think he's holding some sort of grudge. He's maybe more so looking out for his driver. The quotes don't come across that well, but
no,
he's looking out for, well, I guess, ex-driver now. And Haas said that he wasn't surprised that Grosjean continued with, you know, the plan to switch to IndyCar. I guess it's just kind of surprising, A, to see him go on the record on this, because you don't really hear from owner types that often.
No, Gene Haas isn't a guy that is out there and gets interviewed a lot by any means. I think when you look at team principals in Formula One, I think, you know, we'd say it's Zach Brown gets the most,
yeah,
in terms of,
and that's just because,
you know,
he has
the record
connections with the American media.
Yeah, so it was fascinating. Great story by Chris Medlin for sure on this. And I think at the very least, when we try to find the positive here, is Gene Haas still has a pulse on IndyCar. He still is interested over here. Now, most of that is because one of his former drivers was coming over to IndyCar, but, you know, could it potentially open some doors going forward? I think we can all agree that with Gene Haas signing the Concorde Agreement, he's going to be around in Formula One for a while. That was open to question even as late as after last season. But, you know, could we have Gene Haas at some point in the IndyCar paddock in some capacity? I still think there will be a Stewart team, Tony Stewart team in IndyCar. Why wouldn't it just be Stewart Haas?
Well, IndyCar? And the Haas is Gene Haas, correct?
Correct, yes. So you have Stewart Haas in NASCAR. At some point, I wouldn't be surprised to see Stewart Haas in IndyCar.
Yeah, whether they partner someone with the Indy 500, you know, you could see that venture happening.
At the very least, I really could see it, you know, being a one-off for 1 or 2 years and then maybe, you know, delving into more races and maybe eventually going full-time.
Yeah, I could see that down the road. I don't think that's going to come this year just because of everything related to COVID, but, you know, maybe as early as next year for the Indy 500. You know, it's not like Tony Stewart hasn't partnered for Indy 500 rides before. He did a couple years ago.
Yeah, I mean, just the what to take out of this is the idea that Gene Haas was going to finance somebody in IndyCar is a story, I think, for going forward for IndyCar. Yes, he has those connections with Romain Grosjean, but could it be potentially something going forward for another venture? I mean, could a Chase Briscoe at some point want to do the Indianapolis 500? I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, he's an Indiana guy. But it's come up mostly in stock cars. But when you look at Stewart Haas Racing right now, he would really be the only one of that team that strikes me as a guy that would do the Indy 500. But you never know. If they get a hotshot driver at Stewart Haas Racing and that potentially wants to do the Indianapolis 500 at some point, I think that could be the foundation of Gene Haas returning to IndyCar.
You know, another couple of things we learned related to Dale Coyne Racing is, you know, potential drivers for the 51, the 52, and for a while we thought, okay, Cody Ware, Pietro Fittipaldi will fill those, maybe James Davison, depending on how it plays out. Well, seems like Pietro Fittipaldi off the table after he tweeted a picture of him next to a number 51 a couple weeks ago. It's gone silent for him, but he also has that Haas reserve driver role in F1 that he's back with. But it's looking more and more likely that James Davison will be a part of at least the Indy 500. Something he posted on social media a couple of days ago that has not been confirmed by either Dale Coyne or Rick Ware on the team side. But it sounds like he will take part in the Indy 500. And he made his Cup debut last Sunday with Rick Ware Racing. So he will not be in the 51 car. He would likely be in the 52, according to Nathan Brown of the Indy Star.
So much confusion with this.
Right?
Right, for sure. So we'll definitely see. So, you know, I want to go back real quick with Gene Haas and make sure, you know, because there was Newman Haas Racing in IndyCar.
That was Carl Haas.
Yeah, but it was Carl Haas, and they're not related. Carl and Gene were not related, so... for anybody, you know, it was like I kind of misspoke, said returning to IndyCar, but...
Was Carl Haas, was he Reynard Panos? It would have been Reynard, right?
Yep. And was from Germany. Carl Haas was. So, and with... he was with Lola in Formula One.
That's what it is. Okay.
That's what it was. Yeah.
I knew there was a connection to kart chassis.
But. Yeah, so... But yeah, but back to the never ending saga, it feels like, with Dale Coyne and Rick Ware. At some point, that's going to be announced. Who knows when it'll be, who it'll be, how it will be, but we'll get an answer. We know that those cars, the 51 and the 52, will be on track. 51 for all the races and 52 at least for the 500, right?
Yes, 500 and select other races. So we expect it to be James Davison. Now, he posted, I guess, on Instagram account. It was a private post, but he was wearing an IndyCar fire suit with a Rick Ware Racing logo and a 51 patch.
Well,
he drove
the
51 last year's Indy 500. However, it's been understood that he may not be the you know, the oval only guy. But that one to me would make the most sense, unless it's another driver. And this one would make even more sense. And everyone's favorite guy on track, Santino Ferrucci.
Yay!
Santucci could be back in IndyCar. This from Jenna Fryer, the AP. Santino Ferrucci says his full focus is on NASCAR the next 6 weeks, but he still believes he can put something together for the Indy 500. And follow that up, Nathan Brown of the Indy Star saying, Ferrucci said there's still a good chance he'll end up with an Indy 500 ride for this coming May, despite his partial Xfinity racing season. He'd be open to an oval-only IndyCar role in 2021, but he has to put his Xfinity schedule first. So between a combination of those two guys, I think we'll see our answer on the 51 and 52. It just hasn't been officially announced yet.
I'm perfectly fine with Santino Ferrucci in the Indianapolis 500. Two Same. Starts, two top 10 finishes, one top five.
Yeah, and...
And he aggravates a lot of people, so I'm fine with it.
You know, whether you like him or dislike him, he at least, you know, generates interest.
It feels like the same people that want these guys to have personalities and rivalries are also the same people that point out how annoying Santino Ferrucci is. Isn't that what you want? You want people like this? You want guys that are going to put a wheel wrong or intentional to maybe, you know, spin a guy or whatever? I mean, that's kind of what we want, right? We like drama.
You make an excellent point, because you can't have it, you know, say it one way, but, you know, want it another.
Right.
And if you want to get all indie rivals, you know, throwing it back to a hashtag campaign a couple years ago.
Oh, that had probably like 15 total tweets that used indie rivals.
You at least want someone to not only be that person, but embrace it. And I feel like Ferrucci did that.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed his time in the series, because he was just that guy that grinded people's gears. And there are too many vanilla drivers and everybody's friends and all that stuff. And that's nice and all. We talked about Romain Grosjean being welcomed in and everybody being so nice. And that's fine. But man, there's a little bit of when you have some drivers that mix things up that some guys aren't fans of, or that are sometimes going to be, you know, morons on the track. I feel that adds intrigue, you know? Can't have it both ways.
Nice to have a villain.
Yes. Yes, a villain. Somebody that you want to root against. I mean, that's kind of like, you know, you watch casual races, whether it be Formula One or NASCAR, and I find myself rooting against people as much as I do rooting for people as a casual viewer of those series.
Well, like when F1, it's easy to root against Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes.
And not because he's a jerk. I like Lewis Hamilton as a person, but, you know, because they always win. You'd like to see the underdog win or mix it up somehow. But it's very difficult to watch an IndyCar race and try to pick somebody you don't want to win. Like, you're rooting against them. Sometimes you root against a team. Okay, Penske's won too much, or Nasty won too. But there's not a driver where you look at him and like, I don't like him. I don't want him to win. And maybe that's some of the appeal.
I feel like
people like that.
Will Power was that guy until a couple years ago.
Yeah.
For a lot of people.
If you had to pick somebody right now on the 2021 grid that maybe the most people would say I root against him, who would it be?
Power or Rossi?
Really?
Yeah.
I agree with Power. Really? You think a lot of people don't like Rossi?
Rossi has a lot of fans, but I also think he has a lot of detractors.
Okay.
Huh. I mean, I don't know if that's true, but that's just my guess.
Could be. I don't know. But that's a difficult... Like, I don't know. I mean, Power would be my guess, but he's not like... hated. Just like a couple people out there don't like him, and then I guess that means you're the villain, so to speak. So there was a lot that Santino Ferrucci brought to the series, not just talent. I mean, the guy's still only what, 21, 22 years old.
Mm-hmm.
His whole career is in front of him still, and he showed that he can race a car pretty darn fast, and still growing, still maturing. But I just felt like he was an asset to the IndyCar series because he had talent and he rubbed people the wrong way. And he was perfectly fine with people not liking him for rubbing him people the wrong way.
All right. The other thing I want to get to, we've talked about testing, takebacks, And unfortunately, back in the news, Toronto. They are canceling major in-person events till July 1st, including festivals and other large in-person outdoor gatherings. Thanks to Nathan Brown and the Star for finding this. The Honda NA Toronto is July 11th. Brown adds, Toronto expects residents age 60 plus to begin vaccinations July 1st. Of course, in Indiana, we've been having that age group get vaccinated already at this point. And I wanted to look up some context on why this is. And
yes, bring some context, please.
Some context here. This courtesy of BBC News. So this is an reputable outside source that is not American. I just want to make that clear.
It's not American.
Before we get attacked for using CNN or Fox News.
Yeah, you know, whatever we use, some people would be upset.
But so the headline, the subheadline, Canada secured the world's largest number of potential COVID vaccine doses per capita, but it's struggling to get its hands on some of those doses and to get shots,
yep,
into arms. They just say jabs instead of shots or vaccines.
It's the lingo up there.
Yeah. So they purchased a lot of shots, if you will, but not from the U.S., and that's essentially the problem. They decided to invest in vaccines from European factories, afraid that the U.S. under former President Donald Trump would issue export bans. So, not to get politics into this, but obviously they went the way that they did, and now, unfortunately for them, because the U.S. has actually developed... What, we have three now?
Yeah.
With Pfizer,
soon,
and
Moderna.
Mm-hmm. So, and you got what, Moderna?
I got the Moderna.
And Pfizer will be here where we're at in Fort Wayne, I think, in 2 weeks. So we're pretty close to that. So basically, that is the reason why they're behind. And, you know, as of a week ago, they had about 2.5% of the population had received one dose of the vaccine. That's way behind where we're at in the U.S.
Yes.
Over half of healthcare workers there, and then 12% of people over 80 have been vaccinated. Again, this is about a week old article, but it's kind of the newest thing on this. So this, you know, it's an interesting question. Like, will Toronto happen? I don't know if it's necessarily in jeopardy yet.
Yeah.
But it just gives you pause.
It does. Yep. You know, I got to say, if you probably would have gotten more credibility if you said that stuff was from you read it on Reddit as opposed to Fox News or CNN or whatever. I feel like, oh, Reddit. OK, sure. Yeah. People would believe that instead of, you know, one of the major news networks. But what can you say? I mean, Canada dropped the ball. You know, universal healthcare isn't all great. Apparently, because they're woefully behind in compared to the United States in terms of getting vaccines out. And it could very well potentially cost us the race in Toronto this year and potentially going forward. I mean, that would be 2 years without Toronto. I just don't see that being very economically viable.
Oh, yeah. If it doesn't happen this summer, I would question whether or not it would return. Now, the promoter, which is... What, Green Savory Promotions?
Green Savory, yeah.
They have Portland, which didn't happen last year. St. Pete, which did happen, actually had, what, up to 20,000 fans? I don't know if that many went, but
yeah,
they had a decent amount of fans. And that will be early in the season. Toronto, Mid-Ohio, which that happened, had very limited fans last year, right?
Yeah.
And that was a doubleheader. And I think that's it as far as their races. But, I mean, that'd be a huge blow to them to be out that event.
Yeah, would be very, very definitely for 2 years, for back-to-back years. And, you know, there's been problems in Toronto over the years. You know, it used to be very, you know, wide open and a great circuit and a lot of people. And since they built all those facilities for, was it the Olympics or the Pan Am Games? Or
it was something at Exhibition Place, which is like where the track is. They had some sort of event that cut back. And I just saw the other day that there's like another new proposed hotel there that could cut into parts of the track.
I feel like it's just the cities where the race is held is outgrowing the event, really. And I think the Toronto race anyway, even if it happens this year, is on borrowed time. I very well could see Toronto falling off in the next couple of years. And I feel like it would be replaced by like a Vancouver or something like that.
A Vancouver would be amazing. I could see them going back to some sort of airport circuit, or maybe even going to Montreal at the F1 track. I mean, it's a possibility. You need one Canadian race, and ideally you'd have two or three.
Yeah, I feel like that too. I think you're at least one, and maybe they would like to keep the street race format. But as we know, it's very, very difficult to put a street race together this time in this day and age and keep it together and keep it going. So a lot of questions for Toronto. I hope it happens, but it's really not looking good at this point.
No, it most definitely not looking good for Toronto. We hope it happens, but again, it's just,
like, the good thing is you're in that break that does not have the Olympics, right? Or like July 11th to October 8th, like maybe you can move it back a couple weeks, but I don't know really how much that buys you. I mean, you can move it conceivably back from July 11th to July 25th or even August 1st, but...
Oh, and moving back a street race is tougher because they move it back further and there will be events that are set that
True.
Are happening. And
but who
those
knows?
Events could potentially be, 100%
yeah, that's
capacity.
A good point, for sure. So difficult decision for Toronto. And it's not something where you can wait till June to make a decision at a street course, right? It's not a permanent road course or an oval. You have to logistically plan these things out. So I would think in the next month or 6 weeks, we'll have an answer with Toronto. This won't be dragged out.
All right. So our Canadian listeners, please tweet us, email us, Facebook message us, if we're on base here, if we're off base.
And what are you hearing up there? Is there a possibility for another IndyCar race? We're always hearing rumors down here about Vancouver and Edmonton and whatever, but
Calgary.
Calgary. Up there, what are you hearing and what would you like to see? What would be maybe outside of Toronto that sexy race in Canada that IndyCar could put together, similar to kind of the excitement down here with Nashville, which the tickets just went on sale for that.
That's right. Tickets are on sale for Nashville, 3-day tickets, general admission, reserved. In fact, I already have my tickets, so I am good to go. And if you want to get in touch with us on whether it's the Canada stuff, anything we said earlier, or you just have a strong opinion, please do so. You can find us at newtrackrecordpodcast.com while you're there. Subscribe to our weekly email so you'll never miss an episode. You can email us, newtrackrecordpodcast@gmail.com. Facebook message us, just like New Track Record on Facebook. And then our Twitter handle is IndyCar Podcast. And you can find us on many different podcasting platforms, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, which is probably the number one spot that people listen. Do us a favor, give us a 5-star rating. If you're really nice, write a review. You can also find us on CastBox, Overcast, Player FM, iHeart, Podchaser.
Napster?
I don't think we're on Napster, actually.
LimeWire?
No, I don't think so. But there are just a lot of podcasting platforms. I think we're on TuneIn as well.
Ooh.
But you can basically, how they say wherever you find your podcasts, we're also on Google Podcasts as well. So pretty much wherever you find your podcasts, you can find us. And with that, we get to the mailbag where we take your questions or comments, rants, whatever. And got to start with this email from Nick Fletcher. And this is just hilarious.
Okay.
This is not really a question, just more of a scene setter. All right. So I'm going to read this. And it's a little lengthy, but it's pretty good.
All right.
You fly halfway around the world. Oh, by the way, the headline is F1 at IMS. Picture this.
Okay.
You fly halfway around the world, land at IND, think to yourself, pretty neat airport, a lot of racing stuff. You get a lukewarm Miller Lite draft from whatever airport bar you see first. Call a taxi. Is Uber a thing globally? Anyway, the taxi is a 2003 Dodge Grand Caravan, missing a seat and all three mirrors. It smells like a turn four Portageon at carb day when you get into it, and they rush off. You're vomited onto 465 at 88 miles per hour, immediately forced into one lane, because whether this is at 2022 or 2042, Project West Side Construction is still happening, and you bounce around on busted struts until you hit 16A Crawfordsville Road. You ask the driver to stop at a filling station before you get to your Airbnb. He picks the Thorntons on Crawfordsville Road. There are four homeless in front of the station that is located in front of an abandoned strip mall, across from Jordan's Fish and Chicken, and three different liquor stores. You cautiously buy your ice and four locos, obviously, because you've read about them online, have never seen them in person. You proceed down 16th Street to see the Speedway in all its glory, the shine of the pagoda at night, the main gate glowing and the flags dancing in the breeze. This is pretty neat. Then you go under the viaduct. A lot of bars, even more bars, on windows, less lights with every block. The driver hangs left at Sunset Strip Club on 16th and pulls up to your $190 per night duplex that was a local guide on Airbnb. The Airbnb faintly smells of cigarettes and heavily of black mold. You settle in and start questioning when you can get back to the track area. This was the immediate picture drawn in my mind when you talked about the dumpy part of Speedway. Hopefully IMS can globally caution the entire world of F1 to say the Conrad or JW. Ha ha.
Hilarious.
I thought that was great.
So accurate. That's my that's my concern with IMS. And this is the first thing that pops in my head. It's not a sexy neighborhood at all. And everybody makes such a big deal about Speedway and downtown Speedway. And yes, it's beautiful, but it's like one part of the neighborhood.
You got two or three blocks on Main Street.
Yeah, you have a solid three blocks on Main Street, and that's it. And that's if you go into Speedway, which not a lot of people will. They'll, like you mentioned, they'll come from downtown proper or from the other way, and it's so dumpy. It is, absolutely is. So, look, I know, you know, it's always mentioned, you know, how beautiful Speedway is and all that, how much they did. Yeah, that's great, but that's only one part of the compass from IMS, and that's the only nice part of the compass direction you go in the immediate vicinity of the track. And when we look at all these other tracks in Europe and elsewhere, look, a lot of them are in the mountains, you know, a lot of picturesque settings, all that stuff. You're just not getting that at Indianapolis. You're just not.
It's a different area, but to be fair, the track when it was built, I mean, it was all farmland.
No, it's I'm not blaming anybody. I'm just saying, you know, The revitalization of the neighborhood hasn't been as much as people like to think. I mean, this is how bad it is we got excited when Roger Penske put asphalt in the parking lots because it was just it's so ugly, the surrounding area of IMS. And to me, and to you probably, Caleb, it's homely. I like it. It's laid back. You know, it's not glitzy and glamoury, and you're not surrounded by people parking in Benzes and Mercedes and all that stuff. But that's just not Formula One, right?
The asphalt really dressed it up for me that it kind of was like, wait, what is this?
I'm just used to getting my feet, you know, dodging puddles when I'm walking to the track after parking. But
and parking in, you know, if it rained recently, you're like, oh, this is going to be
rough. Right? Yeah, absolutely. So, look, the glitz and glamour of Formula One just doesn't fit the neighborhood surrounding in the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Not to say that IMS can't be a destination for sure. We feel like it'll likely be back on Formula One. And maybe there are some dumpy neighborhoods around some Formula One tracks, and they're very, very good at hiding it. But I just, you know, once you go under that tunnel, Or you know, whatever tunnel you're on, either if you're on 16th or Georgetown or whatever, it's a different world out there after you leave the track.
All right, this from Jamin Tuttle on Facebook. Feels like your poll results are dead on this week with 50% fan capacity being the top choice. And in fact, 61% of you voted 50% as far as the fan capacity for this year's 500 on your guest 27% guest 25%, 5% guest 75%, and 7% guest 100% capacity. Last week, you guys talked IndyCar parity a little, which got me back over the last few years looking at all the top two car entrant points for each team. And big surprise, Penske and CGR Rule. Andretti was second barely in 2019, and RLL bumped them to fourth in line, only looking at top two cars in 2020. But overall, it's big three with RLL and AMSP, Aaron McLaren, SB close. DCR is top of the rest, but ECR is close. Could have been better in 2020 with Connor's oval points. And the biggest surprise, Foyt is the last kid picked to play every year. Interesting to see what 2021 brings us. But at the end of the day, the best are still the best, and the rest are still the rest.
Very well put. When we talk about competitiveness and in the IndyCar series, it's something we throw out there. It's something that makes us feel good. But is it really as competitive as we think it is? But here's a question, you know, piggybacking off AJ Foyt Enterprises here. They've had, with Sebastian Bourdais in the seat heading into this year, when's the last top 10 finish for a Foyt car in IndyCar for the season?
I'm going to guess Sato in 2013.
I don't know. I'm still looking. 17th.
Really?
Yeah. I will give you a million guesses and you'll never guess.
Ayrton Dare.
Oh my gosh, you got it. No way. No way. Yes, Ayrton Dare, 2002.
Wait, I got the year right too? Are you kidding
yes.
me?
Yes. That's insane.
I just threw that out. It's a wild guess.
Wow. I'm done. I'm out. That's it. We're done. I thought there was no way I would get Jeff Bucknum before I would get Ayrton Dare. But no, this was not scripted whatsoever.
No.
I am shocked.
I
Good
am
job,
too.
Good job, Caleb.
All right. Well.
With that, but yes. So it's been 19 years since AJ Foyt Enterprises has had a driver finish in the top 10 in points. Can Sebastian Bourdais break that skid?
No.
Okay. Moving on.
Next. I still can't get past that. That's wild.
That's shocking. Great job.
I think he could do top 12, but it all comes down to engineering and if they can, you know, the car has to be good on ovals, which it should be, but
yeah.
Also road courses. And I don't know.
But I guess is the benefit for... Well, I don't know if it's a benefit or not. The benefit for AJ Foyt Enterprises is the strength of Sebastian Bourdais on road and street courses mm-hmm. and the amount compared to ovals.
And he's a good oval driver now. I mean,
right,
he's developed
right, right.
into
but
that.
We know, you know, he's very good on road and street. So
they have to. Foyt has to get past wanting to just be competitive at Indy and actually want to be competitive the full year.
Well, I mean, the problem is when your boss, his world revolves around Indy. And that's not a knock on AJ Foyt. That just facts. It's tough to convince him otherwise, or to get him to focus on, hey, you know, Indy's great, but we gotta worry about you know, Mid Ohio. And Foyt doesn't care about Mid Ohio.
No,
right? But you know, Larry does. So yeah, that's the debate. I think a lot of debates with AJ. But who's gonna tell AJ they're wrong?
Nobody. All right. A lot of responses on our fan capacity poll. NK Harden says, should be 100%, but I'm sure it won't. I'll refrain from making some sort of political statement, but it should be 100%. Poet Shevchenko, combine broad vaccination in the most vulnerable demographics, 5-minute COVID tests, masks, an open venue with lots of space to spread out. I think you have a recipe where 50% attendance is easily attainable. Jensen EV on Twitter says, I can tell you what it should be, but the histrionics surrounding this disease long after we've collected enough data to understand its lethality and who is at risk is ludicrous, so I expect half or less. Incaptine 185, most likely 25%. NCAA tourney at Lucas Oil is allowed 25% in a closed facility. The same stands true for IMS. We could have 50 to 75,000 fans. Daytona 500 had 50,000 fans 2 weeks ago. Thoughts on this? I think 50% is a realistic baseline right now.
Yeah, you were trying to convince me of this earlier in the week when we were talking about this very subject, and I felt comfortable saying 25%. We've said that for a while, but you, as we're seeing the numbers continue to decline and the rapid rate in which more and more age demographics are being included in being able to get the vaccine, you feel reasonably confident it could be 50%.
I feel very confident it could be 50% because, look, the NCAA tournament is coming up in, what, 3 weeks?
I don't know. IU sucks. I'm not watching.
We're not going down that road on this podcast, that's for sure. Right. It's coming up in 3 weeks, and again, it'll be in Indy, and then they're going to play a couple of games at Purdue and at IU, but mostly in Indy and Indy venues, you know, Lucas Oil, Hinkle, Indiana Farmers Coliseum, and Bankers Life Fieldhouse.
Yeah.
And they're going to have 25% capacity. Now, that includes fans, players, coaches, essential staff, family, etc. But that's where they're at right now. You got to think the Indy 500 is 2 months after. So we get to the Final Four, and essentially you got, what, 7 weeks till the Indy 500?
Right.
Because the Final Four is first weekend in April. We're at 25% now. We're seeing the state, you know, color-coded map. I believe we went from, you know, there are 32 counties, and I, as of a few days ago, I think there were 39 counties in blue, and I'm sure this is outdated by now.
But a lot of blue. A lot more blue than we've ever seen.
Correct.
Since they started doing
this.
We
hadn't seen any blue until like a week or two ago.
Yeah.
And then now it's basically half blue. So I see a lot of potential for not only 50%, but this is where it gets tricky. And, you know, IMS officials have confirmed they will host fans for this year's 500. I don't think that's a surprise. Granted, they said that last year and pushed it back, and then it ended up, you know, not being the case.
Right.
But I expect them to have fans. And now whether it's 25% or 50%, 75, 100, I mean, it'll be one of those four numbers. I don't think it'll really deviate a whole lot from that. Charlotte is allowing, what, 30% capacity?
Are they?
That's what I saw the other day.
I mean, everybody's different. So we saw about 20,000 at Daytona, which is about a fourth.
So Charlotte is allowing fans, and it would amount to 30% capacity for the Coca-Cola 600.
Huh.
And this from Nathan Brown of the Indy Star. If you apply 30%, it'd be 72,000 roughly, saying there are 240,000 grandstand seats. And Brown says, back in October, Roger Penske told me 165,000 fans had already committed to coming this year. That gets them to what? That would be a 75-ish percent.
I mean, do we both agree that the infield won't be open?
Yes. Unless things are completely open, then yes, it will not be open unless, you know,
right,
they don't have any kind of capacity restrictions.
I feel like, could you see IMS starting at 25% and then increasing it to 50 at some point? I think that's easier to do than going backwards.
Correct.
So I feel like the initial, what they eventually allow on May 30th may not be the initial announcement because they want to see how it goes. But I think the lateness of the 500 this year, May 30th, can help because every day, every week counts. So I really, if I had to predict right now, I'd still say 25%, but I could see them announcing 25% contingent with a 50% contingent on continued vaccine rates and the decline of cases and all that. But I feel like it's just going to be all grandstand seats. I don't see much, if anything, available in the infield.
Now, you look down the road, and as they move vaccine eligibility in Indiana and, you know, across other states in the country, you know, we're at, what, 60 plus now for the vaccine? Is that correct?
60 plus starts on Monday, I think, right?
Okay, so...
in Indiana.
That's where we're at now, and Monday is March 1st. So, you know, that's a big bulk of the high-risk population because they've already done, you know, healthcare workers, first responders, and then now they're going to be at 60-plus. And then you get to mid-March, you'd think they'd be at 50-plus. You'd get to late March, you know, 40-plus. April, you know, you're looking at 30-plus. I mean, you get to a point where it's going to be available to everyone by late April, early May, right?
Ideally, I mean, that's as long as the vaccines continue to come in at the rate, and quite frankly, the amount of people that go get it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as you get into the demographics where there are more people, You know, the you know, I think, you know what, 30 to 60 probably is that meaty part of the curve. You know, a lot, you know, people need to go get the vaccine, whether you agree with it or not, just go get it. Because, you know, when we reach a certain percentage of that herd immunity of the amount of people vaccinated, then, you know, more things will open up. So,
and another thing I want to throw into this, because I think this is important. It's probably off the radar from racing fans, but about a week ago, Governor Eric Holcomb, governor of Indiana, signed a bill providing COVID-19 liability protections to businesses and nursing homes. It went into effect immediately, and it would basically provide businesses, including nursing homes, civil immunity from coronavirus-related lawsuits. So what does that really mean? Well, if you believe you got COVID at a business or a nursing home,
you cannot sue them.
You cannot sue. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing that has honestly held up this whole time during the pandemic. The lack of liability protection for businesses, that's what's caused events to have limited or no capacity.
Yeah.
It's not the risk factor of spreading the virus.
It's the risk factor of being responsible.
Correct.
And being held liable. Yes. It's a great point. So now you have that protection, at least in the state of Indiana. So that's going to do. Look, I think Roger Penske is going to be as aggressive as possible to put butts in the seats, but you don't want to overextend it either. So,
well, and the bill provides exceptions to civil immunity for gross negligence or willful or wanton misconduct. So if, say, we're still having cases and in late May and numbers are where they're at right now or even going up, and they just open it up full capacity, I mean, that's going to be on IMS.
It will be, yeah. So, yeah, you know, you're convincing me here, Caleb, you know, more and more that at least 50% is possible. But it's still a ways off. We're trending in the right direction. But if it continues to trend in that direction, you know, we'll be in good shape. So let's hope it continues. But it's tough to compare it to Charlotte or Daytona or whatever, because every state's different, right? So just because X track or Y track's doing this doesn't mean the Indianapolis Motor Speedway will have more or less capacity. So it's strictly an Indiana thing, and Indiana's trending in the right direction. We're looking good. Keep getting those vaccines, keep masking up, and hopefully we'll have a butt ton of people at the Speedway on the 30th.
And this just in from Michael Knight. You can follow him on Twitter, SpinDoctor500. I believe he's a motorsports writer for Arizona Central. He's worked in kart. I mean, he has a lot of motorsports experience. He tweeted just minutes ago, also from Roger Penske today. One, he reaffirmed plans to run the Indy 500 as scheduled in May with an unknown number of fans on site. Talks with local and state government officials continue. Two, Team Penske would like to return to IMSA and go to Le Mans with the 2023 cars.
That's cool.
Yeah, so again...
Did you expect something?
No. It's just more that, okay, we're on the right track, and I think, you know... Look, 50% to me seems very doable for right now. But if cases continue to trend downward, which they have been the past few weeks, if vaccinations continue to be at or above the level they're currently at, and the age ranges continue to go down as far as the, you know, number to younger people, I see an outside chance that by late May, I'm not talking May 1st, I'm talking late May, an outside chance, as long as vaccine supply is strong and cases continue to go downward, as they have been the past few weeks, there's an outside chance, and I'm talking like, what, 5%, 10%, that we could see stuff fully open up late May, early June, as opposed to, you know, later in the summer.
I feel like, yeah, fall is that, late summer, early fall is probably that, you know, return to normal, hopefully.
To me, it's, you know, July, like maybe June, but probably by July.
I feel like, you know, the stretch run for Major League Baseball could see, quote unquote, mm-hmm. regular crowds, playoffs for Major League Baseball, the start of the NFL season, college football, maybe. But that's where I see, you know, that quote unquote return to normal. I just don't see it being in late May. But I think there are going to be restrictions and regulations. But if things continue to go the direction they are, they won't be as drastic as maybe we thought even a month ago.
Well, and stuff's not going to suddenly be open overnight. It's going to be gradual. And I think everyone just expects for there to be just this day where it's like, oh, it's over and everyone just goes outside and does stuff again. I don't think it's going to be exactly like that.
But I think you're definitely seeing gradual stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, when you look, you know, I caught earlier, you know, that right now there's a high school game going on just outside Fort Wayne in New Haven. And you look at the stands and it looks like a quote unquote normal Thursday night crowd for a boys basketball game in Indiana. And we haven't seen that in a while. So it's those gradual things, slowly but surely, state by state, county by county, getting things done. And if things continue the way they're going in the state of Indiana, we have a great shot at what will look like a very good crowd, at least on television, on the 30th.
All right, we got a lot more tweets to get to, actually.
Let's go.
So we'll continue on. These are some responses last week on Canada and TV. This from Vicky Lynn 26. About us Canadian viewers, I don't exactly recall how many races Sportsnet showed in 19, as we only watched the ones on SN World that weren't on big NBC. Last year they showed all the races, but that probably had more to do with the constant schedule changes. Most didn't show up on, she said PVR. Is that a different thing, or did she just mean DVR?
I don't know.
I don't know if it's named something different.
Yeah, I think it's PVR, maybe. A personal video recorder could be PVR.
Okay. Well, showed up on my PVR until a day or two before the rescheduled races. I'm assuming it will be the same this year, but at least in Vancouver, SN World is a premium channel we had to add to our cable package. I've heard different in Eastern Canada. Then M. Vanny on Twitter says, your assessment of Canadian TV is pretty correct. Sportsnet did have most of what was provided on NBC Gold last season on a streaming product called Now Plus, but the cost is over $20 a month if you buy annually. Availability of Peacock is governed by broadcast laws, not NBC offering it. So a little bit of context.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, it's not perfect. I just like to get this, you know, the story straight from our friends up in Canada, as opposed to IndyCar trying to spin it because they want to make things sound positive, right?
Correct.
So keep us informed on how things are going up there.
This from We Are the Race on Twitter, and everyone's super excited because the IndyCar iRacing Challenge is set to return. Asked if people would watch. Vicky Lynn 26, 100%. It was a lot of fun to see here the boys let loose on each other, unlike when they're in their real cars, hoping for fewer controversies, though, looking at you, Simon Pagenaud.
I feel it's going to be less serious than it was last year.
I would agree.
Last year, you know, it was who knows when we're going to get back to racing, and it's been forever, and they hyped it up, and they put it on television and stuff, and even then it degenerated into silliness, which was fine with me. I don't really care.
Yeah, it was entertainment.
Yeah, right? It's entertainment. So, yeah, I see it even being less serious this time around.
I'll definitely watch. If they do more than, like, two or three races, to me, that's too many.
Did they say, will it be on NBCSN? Will it be on IndyCar?
No, I didn't see any official announcements on this. A lot of comments on this. Jensen EV says, only if they have had more time to think about its execution. Many drivers were happy about doing it. Their job is to drive cars, not bad facsimiles of them.
Rossi.
he says, ask Newgarden or Rossi if they're excited for more. Pilot Shevchenko, I would if for no other reason than it makes the offseason a little shorter. Exactly. DC Soda, it was fun last year. I'll definitely check it out. Nick J. Fletcher, I think they would get less frustrated with it being not real if they were driving USF 2000 cars at North Wilkesboro Speedway or DPIs at Bristol or Outlaws at Charlotte. That's exciting to me, and I think they would be able to disconnect from it being not real cars and setups. That's an interesting idea.
No, you know, part of what my point here. Look, you know, I know the seriousness of iRacing. I understand that people are really serious and how authentic it can be. But when we talk about building these guys as personality, and that's one of the big issues that people have with IndyCar is who are these guys? And they're all so vanilla and they have nothing to say. What about creating some sort of fun tournament, competitive tournament? Like, what if you divided the paddock or whoever's participating in iRacing, two teams whoever scores the most points in each race, you know, that goes toward the championship or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you just have guys compete against each other and make it competitive, but also make it loose and fun. And you know what? If such and such wants to spin somebody out, then whatever. I mean, but it's also competitive. It's also maybe have, you know, the winners get, you know, $100,000, you know, donated to a charity, to an IndyCar charity or something, in their name or something, you know? Make it fun. Show the personalities of these guys. Make it loose. You can have Alexander Rossi and Joseph Newgarden and those guys that aren't fans of sim racing and iRacing maybe a little bit more, you know, relaxed and have fun with it, as opposed to trying to tell them how serious it is and how they should take it serious, and some of the fans being outraged when they don't take it serious. Just intentionally make it fun and amusing. And I think that's something that NASCAR does a tremendous job with, is making, putting their drivers into situations that really showcase who they are, and loose and fun and personable. And IndyCar does not do a good job with that. And not everything has to be serious all the time, particularly when it's fake racing. And I feel like that's something that I think more people would gravitate towards, having some sort of charity pro-am-esque iRacing tournament where the winning team gets a donation to the to their charity or something, as opposed to trying to hammer to these guys that, hey, this is serious, take it serious, which not a lot of guys are going to do.
Well, and Nick J. Fletcher follows that up with a great idea that kind of goes hand in hand with what you said. I tweeted, my opinion only, it's wildly unexciting to see them drive DW12s on a current IndyCar track. Give me IndyCar drivers racing presidential limousines at Spa. Newgarden did this on Twitch, on Forza.
Really?
I'll watch that all day. Make it something different.
Yeah, exactly. Make it different. Make it fun. Make it able to show these guys off the cuff a little bit, you know? And I think that'd be cool. I mean, even show it on delay so some of these guys can, you know, maybe use colorful language that can get bleeped out. I mean, I don't care. Like, that's... I think these guys have personalities. I think for a long time, IndyCar just hasn't showcased them, you know? And part of it is, you know, yeah, a lot of them all get along and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I feel like I know, you know, for example, I feel like I know a Kyle Busch or a Joey Logano more than I do a Alexander Rossi or Ed Carpenter. And that shouldn't be it, because I watch a hell of a lot more IndyCar than I do NASCAR. But I feel like those guys are more personable. It's just how they approach things. And I'll repeat it. You know, last week, Clint Bowyer and Jeff Gordon in the booth, phenomenal. And they did an intro where they were beating and banging two cars, which I'm shocked they did. And I don't know if you saw it, Caleb, in pre-race, right before the race started. One was in a Chevy, one was in a Ford. Regular street cars, and just beating and banging around the road course at Daytona. Just the two of them. I mean, knocking off headlights and all that stuff, and spinning Jeff Gordon out and all that stuff. And you know, the whole premise was they were racing to the booth, right? And then they show them getting out of the cars and running in and all that stuff. And it could have been cheesy. It very easily could have went that way. But instead, it was fun. It was cool to see those guys cut loose a little bit. And Clint Bowyer is just the greatest in terms of loose and fun and making things relax, but also being serious. It was just that interaction that, you know, you feel comfortable with those guys. And it was very well executed by Fox, for sure. And it's just another example of how NASCAR does things to highlight not just their drivers, but broadcasters, too, having some fun.
Zach Curley 8771 adds, not as desperately as I did last year, but I may tune in to one or two. There are other sports going, though. Tough competition. I think that's the key, is, you know, if they're going to do this before the IndyCar season starts, I mean, they got a month and a half to get this in, and you got to make it entertaining, but you also don't want to go against the NCAA tournament, and it gets tough after that.
And that's why it has to be a different format, because if it's the same as last year, nobody's tuning in, because we have racing in 6 weeks, right? We're not desperate for any type of auto racing. You know, we have NASCAR going on. Formula One is a month away. So I feel like it has to be something different. Make it fun, make it loose, put the guys on teams, make it something. Maybe all of them are racing for a charity or something. You know, make it worthwhile, make it different, make it fun for the drivers. I feel like you're going to get a lot more positive response from casual IndyCar fans as opposed to the ones that complain that they're not, quote unquote, respecting iRacing, because I feel while that's exciting to us and sim racers and iRacers, the IndyCar drivers do it for real life. It's the real thing for them. They don't need a video game to excite them because they have the real thing. We don't.
And this whole thing is just for our entertainment. So
yes, entertain us, but in a way where we get to know these drivers and have a little fun and mix it up a little bit and all that. It doesn't have to be serious.
Why so serious?
Why so serious?
this is a reply to the Santino Ferrucci Indy 500 potential news. This from R. Cole. You know, he wasn't the best or most liked driver in the paddock, but he was fun to watch. This generation's Thomas Schechter. I like that comparison a lot.
Very much so, for sure. And it's very accurate. And yeah, if Santino Ferrucci tomorrow announced an Indy 500 ride, it would get a lot more response than the majority of our one-offs for the Indy 500. Why?
Correct.
Because there's diversifying, polarizing opinions of Santino Ferrucci. That's a good thing for the series.
IndyCar, and I texted this to you today, but they actually posted on YouTube the full US 500 broadcast from 1996 and tweeted about it. And I love the narrative that they used. In 1995, NFL Hall of Famer Walter Payton, a motorsports enthusiast and sports car driver himself, became the co-owner of an IndyCar Series team. Today, we head back to the 1996 US 500, where his team scored its best finish.
Nice roundabout
yeah.
way, right?
But put it out there? This from Incapteen 185. I was at that race in 96. Craziest thing I've witnessed at a race. Cars all over. Tires and parts flying into the crowd. Multiple spectators were lifelighted out of there. Ambulances all over. Wild, wild start.
Hey, that's racing.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Let's see. And we got a couple more, and one of these on something I'm going to get to in a second. Poet Shevchenko saying, just bought 3 3-day tickets to Nashville, Grandstand 7, hoping to help make that event a success. I believe, I need to double check my notes here, I believe I'm also going to be in Grandstand 7. Yes, Section 7.
Wow.
So, hey, come say hi. Well, I'll be in a group.
He'll be the drunk belligerent one in Section 7. Look for Caleb.
This from Connor Klinkenbeard, C. Klinken. Thoughts on Gene Haas, one, planning to sponsor Grosjean in IndyCar, and then two, subsequently backing out because he thought RG should have retired after the Bahrain crash. Number one feels like a big deal had it come to fruition. Yeah, and we talked about this earlier. I think it's a big deal in the sense that even though Gene was cutting Grosjean, you know, out of F1, that he was willing to support him moving forward. I think that says a lot about the relationship between the team owner and the driver, right?
Yeah, and you know, Chris Medlin has a good string of tweets here about this after he put it out there, and, mm-hmm. and one of them says, you know, my take is that it was a way out of a deal that he wasn't fully committed to, talking about Gene Haas. When he was originally looking to help out a driver who gave a lot to his F1 team, Haas felt lucky one of his drivers didn't die, so is saying, why roll even more dice when I don't really want to? He said, essentially it's a money thing, but it does have some logic to it too. The more cars and series you enter, the more chance of an incident. But at no point did he say IndyCar is more dangerous than Formula One for anyone making that argument. So some context there from Chris Medlin, who we'll talk more about next week. And, you know, following up again from Chris Medlin, definitely sensing some general Haas resentment too, that isn't really about this specific situation. I think it was just a convenient way of opting against spending more money that he was never compelled to spend.
Well, and you know, riding off an F1 car, I mean, that's incredibly expensive,
right?
And that's what he had to do there. This from Poet Shevchenko, and this actually dovetails perfectly into what I wanted to get to first in news and notes. And he tweets us, if you want to talk about third OEMs, is IndyCar hamstringing their own efforts by requiring OEMs to buy in big with sponsorship? Maybe time to make a bold move and make that voluntary instead of mandatory. I don't think it's the sponsorship aspect that is the problem, because Honda and Chevy seem pretty locked in and committed, and as far as sponsoring things and, you know, title sponsor races, TV ads, all that, activation at the track, I mean, that all seems solid, right? I mean, in a normal year, I didn't feel like that's an issue.
And I feel like, you know, overall, the overall investment for an OEM, when you break it down, the sponsorship aspect isn't really a big chunk of it, right? I just feel the majority of it is the investment into the engine and the power plant itself.
Yes. So, and the engine leases, and just the fact that the money for the OEM is financially, you know, not there because they're losing money on it.
Yeah. And look, I feel that IndyCar probably has had this conversation several times with OEMs, prospective OEMs, saying, hey, if you're not comfortable spending X amount on activation at these tracks, perfectly fine early on. I mean, I don't feel IndyCar is turning down an OEM saying, nope, you have to sponsor at least two races and you have to have activation. I just don't see that being a thing.
Yeah, I don't either. Now, what I do see, and we got the news this week, not a surprise, but Ferrari confirmed their return to Le Mans with the top class with the new hypercar program. Not a big surprise, because we thought they'd go sports car racing with that extra money and staff from F1 due to the cost cap, that they had to find a way to give those people jobs and an outlet. And IndyCar was looked at, and however serious that was, you know, we'll never know. It was serious enough that the name got out there, and there were a lot of articles and a lot of speculation and a lot of, you know, excitement and disappointment over all of it. Was it ever really going to happen? I mean, we debated many, many months ago about how it would ultimately be a bad thing for IndyCar, because Ferrari would want to write their own rules for it, right? So to me, though, this whole Ferrari thing goes back to the issue with finding a third OEM. And, you know, maybe to me, I mean, yes, Honda and Chevy are locked in, but to me, could the issue be that IndyCar's formula is simply just not enticing to a potential third engine manufacturer?
I think you could definitely say that about the current formula. Now, adding a hybrid component, I think, sexies up the thing a little bit.
And that would have been necessary to land Porsche,
right,
which was the first, you know, name that popped up. What was that? Was that 2019, 2020?
I can't remember.
I mean, that was the first, I think it would have been 19.
Yeah.
But that was the one that they were close with.
Yeah.
And it didn't work out.
You're seeing a further move into the future of cars. I mean, hypercars with their technology translates more to the road than an IndyCar engine. It just does. And I know the old school people hate Formula E and all electric cars, but I'm telling you, that day is coming. If IndyCar is to survive, when you look at the general direction of automakers, the future is electric cars. The future is alternative energy.
Correct.
Replacing the internal combustion engine. And IndyCar is going to have to get on board at some point, or it's not going to survive. And I think, you know, Caleb, you mentioned it. It's a great point. You know, IndyCar was late to the party. Everybody else was ahead of the game, whether it be hybrid technology or whether it was electric or whatever. IndyCar is behind in the game, and now they're playing catch up, and they're still behind. And so that's why they're losing out on these OEMs. It's still profitable for an engine manufacturer in NASCAR. So I don't think that's a fair comparison, saying, well, NASCAR has three manufacturers. Well, technically they have two. And Toyota does what? Four cars, five cars? It's very small.
Oh, really? It's that few now?
Yeah. They don't have very many cars. So there's two manufacturers that are carrying the majority of the load in the NASCAR field. Toyota has maybe two teams. So even NASCAR doesn't have the size of OEMs that it used to. You know, just a couple years ago, it had four. Now it's down to 2.5, I'd say, in Toyota. And you're looking at the numbers now. I don't think there's very many teams that have Toyota.
They have five.
Five cars?
Full-time cars.
Yeah. See, it's very, very few.
Joe Gibbs and 23XL Racing.
Yeah. So even NASCAR is struggling with these OEMs, and Toyota's not investing a lot in their NASCAR program. So, to get back to the main point, IndyCar needs to be more drastic, I feel, because it's going to be left in the dust. And when you hear a manufacturer like GM come out a couple weeks ago that say they're going to be, what is it going to be, all electric or a carbon neutral or whatever it was?
GM, I think all electric by, what is it,
2030, I think
34
it was.
Or 5?
2035? I mean, that's not a long way off.
No.
Right? So that's one of your two primary OEMs that are already looking at going all electric, all alternative energy in the next decade plus, 10 to 15 years. So, you know, the old buggers are going to say, you know, never, you know, I want to hear those engines and back in my day and blah, blah, blah. Things are changing. Things are changing on the road, and things are going to change in auto racing, or it's going to completely disappear. What do you want? And just because it's an electric car doesn't mean it doesn't have any sound. I mean, you know, it's kind of silly. So we'll see going forward. But I think IndyCar, while they're making steps in the right direction, are they too late?
This from Robin Miller's racer.com mailbag. Tickets for St. Pete will go on sale early next month. That's all I know for sure. And then he had a follow-up on Indy 500 tickets and a statement from IMS President Doug Bowles. Tickets for the Indy 500 are available now via the website or calling the ticketing office. And some people are still purchasing or promoting that at this point, but have remained on sale for those that want to purchase. So if you want to buy tickets, you can. He also said we anticipate a more detailed update as the next few weeks play out, and we have a clearer picture for May as far as, you know, what is possible.
Gotcha.
So not a surprise there, but just an update on things. Quite a few little smaller announcements for teams, sponsorship. Going back to one, they had the reveal for Takuma Sato on the BorgWarner Trophy on Friday. They also announced that People Ready will be on the number 30 car for Takuma Sato for Sato this year, and they will be back for the Indy 500 livery, I believe. And then they also announced another sponsorship, because it is a busy week for them. Digital Ally Inc. Brand Shield Health Protection Products, primary sponsor for Takuma Sato for 5 races in a multi-year agreement. So a lot of sponsorship. Amazing what winning the Indy 500 can do for sponsors.
It's great that that car is covered in sponsors, but it's also very difficult on the eyes, especially that shield livery.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where I'm supposed to look. There's a lot going on in that car, and that's a good problem to have. I just reinforce that. There's a lot of sponsors on that. That's better than bare side pods, but I don't know if it's the color scheme or just the amount of sponsorship. My eyes don't know where to look when I look at that shield cleanser's car.
Aaron McLaren SP announced a multi-year partnership with Views. They'll have a new livery for Felix Rosenquist 7 car. And again, Aaron McLaren SP's car launch is Friday, so tomorrow, and they will have that. And I believe it'll be streaming on YouTube. They'll have all that covered.
Do you think there'll be the different colors? Can we be able to tell the difference between aero cars?
I hope so, because that goes to our next announcement with the Carvana car for Jimmy Johnson. And it looks kind of similar to the Aero McLaren SP cars from last year.
A little bit.
So that I really hope it's different.
Likewise.
Dale Jr. has joined the Music City GP ownership group. Will help promote the event.
Everybody's on there.
Yeah. Timberlake, Dale Jr.
When do we get an invite?
Great question. Tony Kanaan is going to be doing stock car racing in Brazil. Will be teammates with his friend Rubens Barrichello. I didn't know they had a Brazilian stock car racing series.
Me neither.
It looks pretty cool. It kind of reminds me of like a supercar car, like in Australia.
Right. Nice.
Let's see. Ignite Autosport. This is a USF 2000 team. Cape Motorsports partnered with karting team Ignite Autosport. And I believe the ownership at Worldwide Technology Raceway are part of this. So that will be a direct link from karting to USF 2000. So that's an exciting announcement there. Carlin Racing, one of our favorite teams. Now, I only saw this because it's on the IndyCar Twitter, since we cannot access Carlin Racing on Twitter. That remains a...
That's point of contention.
Yeah, remains, you know, just a troublesome thing for us. But IndyCar posted this, and I thought it was worth pointing out. But they tweeted, curious what the seating position is like in an IndyCar. Carlin Racing has Max Chilton walk you through the seat fit. Well, huh. Considering he's not been confirmed back for Carlin, you would think that's a pretty sure thing.
Yeah, good. Right? Good thinking.
So, again, only saw it because the IndyCar, you know, official IndyCar Twitter account tweeted that out. Otherwise, would not have known. Would have no idea to know what Carlin's up to.
Yeah, we wouldn't know. We're not privy to that info.
Correct.
So please, our listeners, keep us updated with what's going on at Carlin. I saw they announced an Indy Lights entry.
Yeah, that was last week.
Oh, sorry. See, I'm behind. I don't know what's going on at Carlin.
Marco Andretti tweeted this the other day, having some sports car fun at Sebring, and then Tony Dezeno, with some context. It's an LMP3 entry during the IMSA prototype challenge by his cousin Jarrett and Tristan Herbert. They were testing at Sebring, so Marco got some laps in there. And again, so he's got the SRX thing. He will be doing the Indy 500. And he mentioned some interest in sports car racing. So, you know, maybe he could put something together for that as well this year.
Maybe.
I think sports car racing would be a good fit for him right now.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Just try something new. You know, maybe get away and get back to why you love racing. I mean, I don't know.
Yes, yeah. Find some fun in it, which I think that's what he wants to do.
Correct. And I think he's on the right path for that. Okay, so we got a couple other things to get to. Goodyear to buy Cooper Tire for $2.8 billion.
With a B.
With a B. And you brought this up, that has an impact on the road to Indy.
It does. I mean, couldn't. But Cooper Tires is the official tire of the road to Indy, and now it's owned by Goodyear,
which is a competitor, a direct competitor of Firestone.
So, could there be something there? Could there not be? I don't know, but it's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, definitely worth looking at. Good news here: Lindy Thaxton, you know, former pit reporter on NBCSN for IndyCar, her PET scan last week came back cancer free. She went in to talk about her oncologist, so great news for her.
Saw that. Awesome.
All right. Got a trivia question, then we'll get to Tweets of the Week. All right, this is from Indy Stats.
Okay.
I have the answer, so I can't, you know, participate.
Oh, crap. More pressure on me.
Trivia, the opposite of last week's question. Since 1996, how many races have been led by only one driver? Bonus points for correctly guessing the drivers and the races. Answer will be revealed. Well, they say tomorrow, but I already have the answer.
Dear Lord.
So just guess the number.
How many races?
Correct.
Three.
No.
No? A lot more?
A lot more.
I would think, like, with pit cycles and stuff, that would... 12.
Nope.
800. 17.
Very close. 18. Can you believe that? Since 1996, a driver has led every lap of a race 18 times, and I'll run down all of them.
That is pretty a lot more than I thought.
Dario Franchitti, 1998, card at Houston. Dario, 1999, card at Toronto. Brian Herta, 99, card at Laguna Seca. Elio, 2001, card at Long Beach. Elio, 2001, card at Detroit. Gilles DeFerrin, 2001, card Houston. Cristiano D'Amato, 2002, card Toronto. Bruno Junqueira, 2002, card at Denver. Patrick Carpanier, 2003, kart at Laguna Seca. Paul Tracy, 2003, kart Toronto. This says BJ, 2003, kart Road America. Oh, Bruno Junqueira.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Dixon, 2003, IndyCar Richmond. Hunter Ray, 2004, Champ Car Milwaukee. Bourdais, 2004, Champ Car Mexico City. Dario, 2009, IndyCar Sonoma. Will Power, 2011, at Barber and IndyCar. Scott Dixon, 2012 at Detroit. Will Power, 2020 IndyCar Harvest GP2. That is the list.
Wow, I didn't even realize it was last year. It was the most recent.
Yeah, I would not have guessed that.
Wowzers.
All right, anything that we missed?
Yeah, did you see this this tradition where Tradition Never Stops series on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway website?
Oh, you know what? I forgot to get to this. So that's that new like digital thing that they're doing?
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. Like,
I have not looked at it, but tell me more.
It comes out every week, it looks like, at least for the foreseeable future. Every week we'll have a different featured story. And it's very photogenic. A lot of those, you know, multimedia type presentations that you see online that are very use a lot of pictures and video and all this stuff. The first one was on the tradition of the BorgWarner Trophy. So you scroll through, it has stories that pop up, quotes, old videos, you know, the history of the trophy. It's really cool and different and something that's really cool that I think, you know, IndyCar should be doing for a long time, but is finally getting around to doing it. And it looks like this week's will be Willie T. Ribbs will be released. I think it was supposed to be earlier this week, but it's still not unlocked. But every week it's going to be something different. So check it out. The direct link is, let's see here. Just go to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway website and you can find it. I think it's ims.com/tradition. And they're cool.
I will have to check that out. I know they did like a digital archive last year that was pretty cool. And that's when we talked to Donald Davidson about that.
Yeah. So
that was interesting.
A lot. So they're breaking up into three different things. The greatest moments in racing, the greatest traditions in racing, the greatest heroes in racing, all centered around the Indianapolis 500. So you'll have stories on Willie T. Ribbs and Janet Guthrie, Ari Lyndike, the first stocked car test at Indy in 1961. You'll have a big breakdown of the milk and the tradition of the back home again in Indiana, the kissing of the bricks. You have profiles of Foyt, Nunser, and Weldon, and Mears, Gordon, and Johnson. So a lot coming over the next several months at this site. I think it's really cool. A different way to present the history of the Indianapolis 500 that brings it into the 21st century, I think, technologically.
All right, time for tweets of the week. Are you ready?
Yes, always.
All right, this from William Essler, and he is a sports reporter at Sky News Radio. So that's in the UK. And he tweeted this, and he said, "Well, Max Chilton, you asked for an IndyCar version. Did you see this video?"
No. Oh, yes, I did. It was creepy.
It's the IndyCar starting field, like from last year. I think this would have been St. Pete because Scott McLaughlin's in it and Zach Veach is in it as well. Doing the Numa Numa song and they're all talking and it's very weird.
It's very, yeah. I watched a couple seconds of it and had to stop because it was really creepy.
And then this from Graham Rahal. Before you ask, yes, this is the one. And it's a picture of the official pace car from 1971's Indianapolis 500.
Really?
The car that crashed after entering pit lane after the start of the race.
Did it? So they fixed it up? Somebody owns it?
Yeah, he has it apparently in, I'm guessing, Graham Rahal Performance, like his shop there.
Yeah, outstanding.
Yes, so I thought that was really unique and funny.
Yes.
But that wraps it up. So again, next week we welcome Chris Medland, a Formula One writer, broadcaster. You may know him from F1's Drive to Survive.
Oh, he's famous.
That's right, so he's got some cachet, but he's going to talk about F1 drivers to IndyCar. We'll have more on this Haas article and probably do a little bit of F1 chatter as well.
F1 to IMS, we'll see.
Oh, yeah,
that's
true.
We'll see what Chris Medlin has to say about it.
Yeah, there's a lot of connections between IMS and F1, it seems, at the moment. So he'll join us next week, and of course, we'll get to all the IndyCar news as well. For Justin Kinney, I am Caleb Hatch. Thanks for joining us on New Track Record Podcast.
Podcasts by Federated Media. Podcasts by Federated Media.